Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will have an in-depth discussion on H5N1 bird flu. But first, Sierra Leone has declared a public health emergency on Monday to combat mpox, announcing it was stepping up surveillance at its borders after confirming two cases of the deadly viral disease. Health Minister Austin Demby told reporters in Freetown that the confirmation of two cases of mpox in the country has prompted immediate action as mandated by the Public Health Act. Last week, Sierra Leone reported its first confirmed case of mpox since the world's highest alert level for the disease was raised last year. A second case has since been confirmed after a 21-year-old man showed symptoms on January, according to the National Public Health Agency. Turning now to bird flu, data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows that more than 20 million egg-laying chickens in the United States died last quarter because of bird flu. At least 66 human cases have been reported in the United States. Observers say these discoveries, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, raise significant concerns about the evolving nature of H5N1 and its increasing threat to human health, as well as farm animals, wildlife, and even pets. We will unpack all this today with our experts. Joining us live via phone from Guam is Dr. Tom Poole, Senior Veterinarian for Animal Wellness Action. Dr. Poole, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
It's great to have you. Also joining us via phone from Mitchell, South Dakota, is Dr. Jim Keane, Director of Veterinary Science for the Center for a Humane Economy. Dr. Keane, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Leonard.
So, bird flu, H5N1. Let's start with the basic, and I'm going to start with you, Dr. Poole. What is bird flu, and is it only a bird problem, so to speak?
Well, this is influenza. It's a form of influenza, and influenza was originally a poultry disease. Poultry probably had influenza a million years ago, but it jumped into humans sometime in the last 10,000 years when humans began to domesticate animals, and they think that began in Asia, when they started doing dry rice farming, the jungle fowl came out, and then the humans began to domesticate the jungle fowl. And so it's sort of like the example I always use. It's a little bit like the movie Jurassic Park when he talks about, you know, life finds a way. Well, the diseases also find a way. And when you take take one species that has the disease and mix it with another species, then very often they will jump over. Mm-hmm. And so about 65% of all human diseases have animal origins. And COVID was also an animal origin. It was originally a bat virus that managed to get into humans. And so this humans have had influenza now for the last, 8 or 10,000 years. And we have, become sort of developed a certain amount of herd immunity. We have a form of human influenza that we live with, and there's very different kinds of avian influenza, and most of them don't jump into humans even accidentally, but occasionally that does happen, and it happened in 1917. When what they thought was originally an avian variant got into swine and then perhaps into humans. They're not really certain about that. But anyway, that caused the Spanish flu in 1917 and 18 that killed around 50 million people around the world. Some estimates are as high as 100 million people. And it did it with a 2.5% mortality rate. So, it was maybe two or three times deadlier than COVID and still managed to kill that many people. Now, This virus is much, much hotter. H5N1 is much, much hotter than the Spanish flu type. And there's been about 900 humans, mostly Asian poultry workers, that have been infected over the last 17 or 18 years. And about 50% of them have died, even in some of the finest hospitals. So this has been an extremely hot virus when it gets into humans. Fortunately, it hasn't transmitted from human to human yet.
Okay.
But there's a real risk of that, because what happens usually when these things become a pandemic, and we had a pandemic that I just mentioned in 1917, and then there were two other milder ones in 1959 and 1968, where they were, one was called the Hong Kong flu, and these were variants that were much milder forms of influenza, but still they reassorted, is the word that is used, with human influenza. And what that means, Lenore, is that viruses can't reproduce by themselves. They have to have a mammalian cell, or at least some kind of, you know, animal cell, and they hijack that cellular machinery and force that cell to produce new virus particles. And so what can happen is that a person can be infected with human influenza at the same time they're infected with avian influenza, for example, an Asian poultry worker. Mm-hmm. And then you could get what's called reassortment, where that cell then would mix and match these influenza virus particles and create a new virus that had some or all of the transmissibility of human influenza, which is very highly transmissible, and some or all of the pathogenicity, the disease-causing potential of H5N1, which is extremely deadly.
Wow.
And then you could end up with a new virus mm-hmm. that could spread around the world and be devastating.
That's it's really scary. I mean, I don't know if it's the right word to use, but just hearing how you explain this, we just hope for the best. So then, Dr. Kin, what is the current scope and severity of the H5N1 outbreak globally? And are there any hotspots of concern? It seems like the United States may be a hotspot, according to reports.
Well, yeah, right now, I'd say the whole Western Hemisphere is a hotspot.
Okay.
The United States is a higher and greater number of poultry, so it has a bigger effect in the U.S. But this virus started out, as I think Dr. Poole mentioned, in Southeast Asia in the late 1990s, and it kind of then slowly spread across Southeast Asia, Central Asia, into Africa, and it got into Europe probably in the mid-2015 or so. And then it, primarily through migrating birds, but also from moving poultry around. And then it got into North America in 2022 and Canada, and then wild birds spread it across Canada, the U.S., into South America and Central America, and even into Antarctica. So right now, but as this virus likes to mutate, and so the virus is changing all the time. It's not the same virus that started out in 1997, there's probably 1,000 different, you know, small variants of those, just like with COVID. So, but when it got in the U.S., it seemed like it's just more transmissible. It's infected new species. We've had about a million dairy cattle infected in the U.S. in the past year. It's infected hundreds of wild bird and wild animal species, especially cats. Cats are, if you're feral cats, where I live in South Dakota, a lot of feral cats have died from the flu, from this bird flu. So it's just very different. The virus is changeable. So what we have today will not be what we have tomorrow. But definitely within poultry, the U.S. is a very hot spot.
So what does this mean then for the whole idea of prevention, treatment, and even controlling the virus to some extent, when you talk about mutation? If the virus keeps changing constantly, how much impact does it have in terms of controlling an outbreak or helping animals and humans?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Before it got to North America, about 500 million poultry had died, you know, throughout Asia and Africa and Europe. And now in the U.S., we've had 130 million, I'm not sure how many millions have died in Canada, Central America, and South America. And it was considered, at least in the U.S., it was considered a foreign animal disease. And so the response within the U.S. with the foreign animal disease and animals is you kill all the animals. And they've tried that, but it hasn't worked. For 3 years, they've been slaughtered as an animal. So I think it's time, and Dr. Poole may agree with this, it's time to change policy and probably try a vaccination of cattle and even people who are poultry workers and dairy cattle workers, because they're at risk of getting infected.
So, Dr. Poole, what does it look like in terms of prevention? Is there a vaccine that is good for humans to use? And how available is it? What is the policy around it, as Dr. King talked about policy?
Well, influenza is very difficult because it's an RNA virus. And, you know, RNA or viruses can be RNA or DNA. And DNA viruses like polio, they have a little spell checker. So every time that virus duplicates itself, you know, you've got the double helix that unwraps and you duplicate both sides again. And so I think, if I remember correctly, influenza-like is about a 30,000 base pair virus. And so you're basically typing, you know, 30,000 keystrokes, if you want to use that analogy. And you have to get all of them correct. And when you don't get them correct, there's a mutation. Well, DNA viruses have a little spell checker that goes along and corrects those mistakes as they happen. And that's why DNA viruses don't mutate very much. And so the Dr. Salk's polio vaccine from 1950 still works today. But RNA viruses mutate like crazy. And that's why the flu vaccine you get this year won't work next year. And so it's very hard to stockpile influenza vaccines to have something that's going to be ready when it happens, because they're mutating all the time. And so that's why, like, right now they're canvassing Asia, getting antigens to make human flu vaccines for next fall. And it's just kind of a guess. They'll usually take 3 or 4 serotypes that they find and just guess which ones are going to be. And when we guess right, we have a vaccine that has maybe 70% efficacy. And on the bad years, when we guess wrong, it's 15 or 20% efficacy. So it's tough with influenza to get a human vaccine that's ready to go when, for example, a pandemic or something starts. It usually takes around 4 or 5 months in order to produce, a large quantities of a new vaccine. And so that's, I'll cut this off. I'm sorry, Lindor, but that's the great danger of this pandemic, is that we really can't stockpile vaccine in advance. And once this thing is created, once this virus reassorts and we do have this pandemic virus that starts spreading, we're probably months away from having an effective vaccine.
And let me ask you this, perhaps both of you can react to this question. As Dr. Poole talked about the virus being an RNA virus, we saw with COVID-19 that an RNA, mRNA vaccines were developed. What lessons could be learned from the COVID experience to perhaps upgrade or update this vaccine, this flu vaccine? And is this technology anything that could help with H5N1?
Well, Jim, if you don't mind, if I'll take that. I'm sure Jim has an opinion. Dr. Keene has an opinion on that, too. I'm extremely concerned about mRNA vaccines because we just don't have enough, years of work with these things to know. You know, prior to COVID, it took about 5 years on average, between 5 and 9 years, to get a new conventional vaccine licensed. That's how much testing had to be done with a conventional vaccine. But then with this mRNA, which we had never had before, we didn't even have animal mRNA vaccines. And so this was technology we've been playing with for a long time, but we had never, used it widely. So we really had no idea, and in my opinion, still don't have any idea what the long-range ramifications are going to be. Okay. This. And so I wouldn't put an mRNA vaccine in my body right now or any of my family members at all. So I'm very worried about that technology, Lenore.
Okay. And we appreciate your opinion. Thank you so much. Dr. King, would you like to react on this?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Poole that the mRNA vaccines, they're basically untried. The only real advantage I think they have is you can make a vaccine quicker. In terms of effectiveness, the other vaccines, as Dr. Poole said, if you guess right, this is for seasonal human flu, what it's going to be, you're okay. It works pretty well. As far as the H5N1 goes, there's conventional methods. I know in Europe, Finland and France are both vaccinating their poultry against H5N1, and Finland is also vaccinating their poultry workers to protect them. And Mexico has also had good success vaccinating their poultry. Okay. So there are, now again, those vaccines, because they work today, they may not work tomorrow. But I think, in my opinion, these are just conventional vaccines. I believe that we could, or that we should probably use those vaccines in the U.S. because we have so many animals and birds, poultry and cattle infected, that it really puts humans at risk by having that many animals at risk because of, as Dr. Poole said, mutation or reassortment. If a human, a person infected with human flu gets co-infected with a bird flu. So to prevent
I agree completely.
And decrease animal disease, I think we should certainly start vaccinating in the U.S. as other countries have done.
Okay. And let me just say that with regards to COVID-19 vaccine, there are some experts that really believe that it is effective. So, I mean, I guess with time, we will learn more about this. And vaccines evolve. Some vaccines do evolve. So we'll see what happens with time. Now, it's time to take a short break. And Dr. Keane and Dr. Poole, we will continue this discussion. Very, very interesting. There's so much more that we would like to find out from you. So don't go away. Listeners, we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. You are listening to Health Chat. If you are just joining us, so we are discussing bird flu, the H5N1 virus. Our guests are Dr. Tom Poole, Senior Veterinarian for Animal Wellness Action, and Dr. Jim Keane, Director of Veterinary Science for the Center for a Humane Economy. So let me ask you, what are the symptoms when an animal has bird flu versus a human? I can toss that to you, Dr. Poole, perhaps?
Sure. Well, it's very much a respiratory disease. And so, for example, in poultry, it's fairly standard. I mean, they have a lot of, sort of like a human with a cold, and they have a lot of discharge from their sinuses. They get weak. They get scruffy. You'll see their feathers kind of pop out, and they stop eating. There's a lot of wheezing and that sort of thing, difficulty breathing. And with H5N1, then there's very often sudden death. I mean, these birds will die within 24 hours. And the mortality rate can be very high, has been in some earlier cases. Now, it's a little worrisome. We sort of don't really know what the mortality rate is now for the last 3 years or so, because we've been killing everything that, in the way of birds, that get it. And so we haven't given, you know, herd immunity any chance at all. So I really don't know what the current mortality rate is of this thing. It was very high before, and this does tend to be a highly pathogenic version. You know, you classify poultry influenza as a high path or low path, and this is a very high pathogenic virus, very high mortality rates. But we don't really know what it is right now, in my opinion. Now, would you agree, Jim?
Yeah, we don't really know, because we kill everything as soon as there's the first animal is infected.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But I would say, Lenore, one thing different, as I said, the virus is spilled over from wild birds to poultry, mm-hmm. and from wild birds to wild mammals, and to even sea mammals like dolphins. And in those mammals, it tends to be encephalitis, a brain disease. Because mammals are different from birds, so it affects mammals different from birds. They get febrile, then they usually die without transmitting it to another animal. I'm not as familiar with the human. I assume human flu is like the seasonal flu, but I'm not. Do you know, Dr. Poole, what the H5N1 symptoms are in people? Because I'm not familiar with that.
Well, the roughly 900 people that have been infected, and they were mostly Asian poultry workers, it has been absolutely devastating. And this disease, this H5N1 in humans, has been very different from, for example, COVID and from seasonal influenza. You know, we lose about 30,000 Americans every flu season, and it's mostly the very old, you know, the very weak, the sick, the immunocompromised, those are the ones that die. But these 900 people that have been infected with H5N1, it's been the other way. it's been the younger and healthier people, in that this thing tends to turn your own immune system against you. And so you have this what's called a cytokine storm, and you have, you sort of auto-digest your own lungs, and the better your immune system is, the more quickly you die. And we had sort of an example of that a few years ago in our 2009 influenza season. We had an H1N1 variant that came out of, again, out of pigs. It was a poultry virus that jumped into pigs and then into humans. And that one killed about 18,000 Americans under the age of 50. So it was a very different form, and that one just sort of went by quietly. But, you know, COVID had, the average age of death in the United States was above 82 degrees, and they had on average 2.5 serious comorbidities. So it was killing our very old and our very sick. H5N1 appears to be very different when it infects humans, and then it tends to be, you know, really hot. Now, that's a little different because we've now had, as Dr. Keene said, about 66 people that have been infected in the United States, two-thirds of those with this cattle variant. And so far, it has been mild in humans, with a single exception in America, this one man who died. He got very ill, and he had some comorbidities. And then there was a 13-year-old girl last month in British Columbia, and she very nearly died. And she and that man both had a similar variant of this thing, that this virus looked like it was trying to mix, that it was trying to do this thing that we're talking about, this reassortment. Mm-hmm. And so it can be, I guess we really don't know at this moment what it's going to be like in the human case.
So let's talk about transmission. How is it transmitted in general among animals, and then between animals and humans? And one of the reports that both of you authored talked about cockfighting and mink farming as proven threats of spreading bird flu. What is this? And tell us more about it.
Go ahead, Dr. Poole.
Well, I think that, you know, Jim's probably the bigger expert on the mink farming angle and that sort of thing. We've had trouble in the United States, in my opinion, trouble with USDA, in that they're not making a distinction between cockfighters and backyard farmers, and they're very different. You know, backyard farmers aren't, you know, taking their birds or running them around the country, mailing them around, mixing them with other foreign birds and that sort of thing. And so the distinction should be very great, but it's just not. We can't tease out in the data which one of these things are really backyard farmers and which one of them are cockfighters.
Okay.
But we have millions of cockfighting birds in the United States, and it's a felony everywhere. But it's difficult to enforce, and these are very dangerous people that tend to be doing it, and this is often a rural problem. So you end up with these sheriffs that are trying to, you know, manage this very difficult, and there's tremendous amounts of money involved with this thing. So I'm very worried about that part of it, that we're not getting the sort of cooperation out of USDA that we need. And I know that's an American problem. It's not an African problem. But in terms of transmission, these are respiratory viruses that usually transmit through respiratory droplets, but they could also transfer via, like, hand contact. And so if you get these respiratory secretions on your hands and then inoculate yourself by sticking your fingers in your mouth or your nose or the corner of your eye, something like that, a mucous membrane, that is how it's most easily transmitted.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Keene, as you assess this current outbreak that we are seeing, why should countries overseas be concerned about it? For example, when you look at the African continent, why is H5N1 a problem that they should be concerned with?
Well, certainly, the H5N1 arrived on the African continent before it made it to North America. It was, and I know that, in particular, I know Nigeria and Egypt had huge poultry outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. 2006,
and also,
yes.
Over to humans, some mm-hmm. human illnesses and some human deaths. So it's been there before. And I'm not exactly current on what the status is right now, but this virus is probably still there because it resides in the wild birds. So And the other issue is, yeah, the migratory bird is moving around. So if something is in the U.S., it could get to Europe, or Europe could get to Africa. It's a bird, you know, birds move north to south seasonally, and they could spread it around. So that's the danger of it. It's not just up to people. So, again, I think the U.S. has an obligation to, since we have the largest outbreak and the most cases by far, we have an obligation to protect not only our own country but other parts of the world like Africa as well, I believe.
Dr. Poole, let's talk about the prevention strategies. I know you talked about it, Dr. King touched on it as well, but if you were to give us some specific steps, two, three steps, what can the average farmer do? What can governments do as well to help citizens and farmers?
Well, one thing is, this is most likely to be, in terms of the human disease, it's most likely going to be a poultry worker. That if we ever do have this pandemic, you know, event happen, it's probably going to start with a cockfighter or a poultry worker, someone having intimate contact with the poultry. Those people should remain current with conventional influenza vaccines. And I think it's been, you know, unfortunate. The COVID mRNA experience has made so many people now vaccine hesitant. And I think that's just extremely unfortunate. I mean, I would be, you know, hesitant for an mRNA vaccine, as I already mentioned, but I'm not worried about conventional vaccines. And a conventional influenza vaccine could be very important because, as I said, this reassortment, the reason reassortment is so important, Lenore, is because these 30,000 nucleic acid pairs that I was talking about, they, you know, whenever you have this typing error, it's usually just like one keystroke here or there and that sort of thing. Whereas virulence or the pathogenicity of a virus may be a fairly large section of that. That may be a few thousand of these nucleic acid pairs that are together. And so that's why you would, it's more likely for a reassortment when you have a whole block of that, these nucleotides rather, that move and are reassembled in a cell. And so for a virus to mutate and suddenly become highly pathogenic or mutate and suddenly become highly transmissible is much less likely. What's more likely is reassortment. And so the reassortment would occur in one cell, in one poultry worker, and that's why if that poultry worker is fairly immune to human influenza, then that reassortment is much less likely. So I know that was a very long answer, but the first thing is I would say is to maintain vaccine status of everybody who is having intimate contact with the poultry. And then I agree with Dr. Keene that we should at least experiment with, we need to try something else, because we've been doing this for 3 years, and we've killed 133 million birds. Well, we didn't kill all of those, but a lot of those, probably most of those, we killed rather than died of the disease. Mm-hmm. And we haven't, and it's not working, so we've got to try something different. So I would agree with Dr. Keene. I would love for us to try either some herd immunity, let some of these birds, let the virus go through a flock and kill as many as it will and see what that is and see what we can do with the birds that survive.
Okay.
Or to try vaccinating.
Okay. And I'm going to give you, Dr. King, the final word. We just have a few seconds. What is the main takeaway or what is the message?
Well, it's a big issue. I would say if you're working with poultry, you know, be careful and don't cockfight.
Okay.
But we can still eat chicken, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the virus is easily killed with cooking, so it's no risk with cooking.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know.
No chicken sashimi, Lenore.
Okay, I got you. Thank you, Dr. Tom Poole and Dr. Jim King. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you,
Lenore.
And that's all for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guests, Dr. Jim King, Dr. Poole. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, with producer Mugbe Yabaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.